Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. It's an election year and you know what that means. Candidates spouting half-truths, falsehoods, and straight-up lies. Our panel of Kansas News Service reporters are in to bust some of the biggest myths they've heard so far in the race for Kansas governor. Later, Kansas City's well-earned reputation for terrible public transportation may finally be changing. Well, it's that time of year when the political claims and counterclaims are flying and who knows what to believe. The races are particularly hot on the Kansas side of the state line this August, and that's where we're going to focus on today. We're bringing in three members of the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR who will break down a series of primary election season myths for us. This is just in time for Tuesday's primary election. Our Kansas News Service reporters are Celia Yopis-Jepson. Celia, nice to have you again.
Great to be here.
Jim McLean's here in the studio as well. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Stephen Basaha joins us from the studios of KMUW down in Wichita. Stephen, good morning.
Nice to join you.
Before we get to the myths, what kind of election has this been? Because I've been amazed, actually, at how, you know, generally speaking, above board and candid and issue-focused these races have been, you know, for the most part. That's my qualifier. But it's really been extraordinary, Jim, given how competitive these races are.
Yes, and they are competitive on both sides.
Yes.
The first Democratic primary in who knows how long.
For right? governor,
for
we're
governor,
talking about.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. With Josh Swatty and State Senator Laura Kelly there, the front runners there, but also Wichita Mayor Carl Brewer in the mix there. But very competitive, and I guess you owe some of that to Secretary of State Kris Kobach, although controversial. He is what he appears to be. He just stands on stage, and he will say things that he knows are controversial and are going to generate some pushback, and yet he sticks to it. So I say that he is what he seems to be, notwithstanding some of the reporting in the recent days about how he made his reputation as an anti-immigrant crusader with some of those deals and he made in small communities across
right.
the country. That was very interesting reporting. But you're basically right. Yeah, it's been a very competitive race. But for the most part, you know, the candidates have kind of mixed it up, but it's been above board.
Celia, how tough was it for you guys to come up with these examples that we're going to listen to here today?
Oh, I think it was pretty easy. Some of them you hear over and over again. And so they get you wondering, you know, well, wait a second. Surely, you know, we can look into that and see if that's true.
You know, that said, Stephen, you know, this is a primary, meaning that the candidates from the same parties are competing against each other here. But even that said, the differences on the issues don't strike me as all that significant in most cases. Am I right there?
I would say most of these candidates on for their particular parties have a lot in common, which where I think you see them trying to find whatever they can to stick out from each other. And I think the two issues where that tends to happen are guns and education, even though, again, they still have a lot in common on those issues, too.
Yeah. What's been the hot issues in the race for governor on the Republican side? Celia, what would you point to?
Oh, well, of course, everyone's interested in taxes, you know, because we had the tax hike as Brownback basically, you know, on his way out. And so Kobach has talked about bringing back the tax cuts. That's a big issue. I do think people are still interested in education because of the ongoing lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the big ones, Steve, because, as you know, Governor Collier, although he's very conservative, like Kobach, signed that bill that increased funding for public schools by $530-some million. Kobach says he would have vetoed it. So there's a flashpoint there between the two of them.
Yeah. How about on the Democratic side, Stephen? Are you seeing, again, many distinctions when it comes to the issues?
No, I think when you go to these debates, they're mostly saying the same things. What they're questioning is often how genuine the other candidates are by bringing up things like their records when it comes to issues such as guns.
Okay. So clearly voters have their work cut out for them. They're going to have to focus on these races to make their picks. I'm actually writing a column about that as we speak. Do I have that right? Again, they're going to have to look at this pretty hard, Jim.
Yeah, I think so. Again, it's a crowded field, relatively speaking, on both sides. The airways are very crowded with advertisements, not only in the governor's race, but these congressional races have been very competitive, too. And so the ways that voters have to gather information in the final weeks and kind of sort these candidates out, yeah, I think they do have their work cut out for them.
Okay. Well, let's go to our series of myths that we're going to be talking about today. And we're going to play a clip from a candidate, and then we'll dissect it with our reporters here. The first one, and we have several here actually, from Secretary of State Kris Kobach, again, a candidate for Kansas governor on the Republican side. This one has to do with an in-state tuition break for undocumented college students. Let's listen to what Kobach says on his TV ad, and then we'll talk about it.
Topeka politicians have spent millions of our tax dollars giving in-state tuition rates to illegal aliens, about $4 million this year alone. I'll end in-state tuition for illegal aliens, and we'll use that money to help Kansas students.
Stephen Bisaha, take that one away for us here.
Yeah, so there's a lot to dissect. First is that $4 million number that he claims would be saved for taxpayers. Now, the Board of Regents has looked into this, and this idea of charging undocumented students the out-of-state rate versus the in-state rate, which could sometimes be two or three times more per semester. And essentially, they found, the Board of Regents said, it was around more like $2.3 million that would actually be saved, not $4 million. And I would just say it's not really saved. It's tuition revenue generated because these students would be spending more on their tuition. This is not like K through 12 where there is dollars tied to specific students and that your number of students affects how much tax dollars are going. The Topeka, the legislature, they decide on a number. It's not, again, tied to any specific enrollment that may factor into things, but they give that money to the system. And again, it's not tied to how much these undocumented students are paying. There's only around 670 of these undocumented students. So again, $2.3 million, 670 students, how much they pay isn't going to really affect the system one way or another.
So this idea that this tuition break is going to drive up tuition costs for other Kansans, you have real questions about that claim.
Yeah, he's making the suggestion that by them paying more, these undocumented students, that's going to, well, he's saying it's going to save taxpayer dollars. What the Board of Regents is saying is that would generate more revenue, and that will make it so that these universities, community colleges, where most of these students are, they'll be able to not raise their tuition as much. There's one major problem with that. Or let me say two major problems. One is this $2.3 million assumes that all those students would stay enrolled, that you would have another 670 students paying that rate the next year. But again, remember, this is thousands of dollars more a semester. These students aren't eligible for federal student aid. A lot of people are questioning whether they'd decide to stay enrolled. They may just leave, which leads to the second point. The universities, the main way they're trying to raise money and to save money is by enrolling as many students as possible, whether it be at that lower in-state rate or the out-of-state rate. We see that because they're doing things like offering to Texas some students, students across the Midwest, even though they're out-of-state, they are offering them the in-state rate because they care so much about these students coming in. So losing these undocumented students because they'd be paying so much more, that has the potential of hurting these universities financially. As one Board of Regents official had told me, they'd rather have a student in the classroom paying that lower in-state rate than not being in the classroom at all because they just can't afford the higher amount.
Okay. Let's move on to a second claim here, a myth that we're going to dissect. This is from Governor Jeff Collier talking about CanCare, a program he's been responsible for setting up in the state.
We reformed that system. We eliminated an entire cabinet agency. And independent studies said that we saved $2 billion. $2 billion.
Jim McLean, did he save $2 billion by doing that?
Not quite. It's a matter of dispute. Not a whopper of a lie, certainly. But this is a very important issue for Governor Collier. As you mentioned, he's the architect of CanCare, which is the state's privatized Medicaid program. They privatized it in 2013. And the 2017 study that Collier points to justifying his claim was written for the CanCare contractors, for whatever that is worth. And it said the state had reduced the projected cost increase in Medicaid. Again, it was a projection that it had reduced that by $1.7 billion, not the $2 billion that Governor Collier refers to. So he rounded up a bit there. And then also a report issued later by state auditors said that the state's CanCare data was so spotty that they simply couldn't make any reliable determinations about cost trends or claims that Collier has also made about improving the quality of care for the more than 400,000 low-income disabled Kansans covered by CanCare. And then finally, Steve, a 2016 study indicated that some of CanCare's cost savings came at the expense of providers, payment disputes, cuts in reimbursement rates, and delayed payments to providers, hospitals, doctors, et cetera. So it's pretty muddy topic. Yes, I think it's pretty clear that the switch to privatization has slowed the growth in Medicaid cost. As to how much, I think it's still anybody's guess.
So $2 billion may or may not be the case here. Doesn't sound like
exactly.
Okay, rolling along here. We have a clip here again from Chris Kobach that has to do with school district spending. Then Celia will take a whack at it here.
If you haven't seen them here, I invite you to go to somewhere like Johnson County or Wichita, where you will see high schools that look like junior colleges. You will see administrative buildings that look like Fortune 500 companies. There's one in Shawnee Mission. People call it the Crystal Palace. I think it was $23 million. It looks like a corporate headquarters. I have no idea what those people are doing in there. They're probably on their phones playing games.
Celia?
Okay, so let's unpack this. First of all, it turns out he lowballed that figure. So he's talking about this building in the Shawnee Mission School District. He mentions it costs like $23 or $24 million.
The Crystal Palace.
Right, exactly. It was actually more than $32 million. But the other thing to know about that building is he's implying that it's just an administrative building. Actually, half of that building is for career programs like engineering and biotechnology. Students go there, high schoolers go there from around the district to do those career programs. So that's part of what's going on in that building. But it was also interesting he picked that example. It feels like he's implying here, because he's building the argument that Kansas is putting too much state money into schools, that state money went into that building. And when I looked into it, actually, that's not the case. The Shawnee Mission School District is very wealthy in terms of its access to local tax resources. So they didn't receive any matching state dollars for that particular building. So it was kind of not the right building to pick on.
Okay. All right. That's Chris Kobach talking about Taj Mahal buildings. Maybe that's not such an accurate claim after all. Okay, let's move on to yet another clip from Chris Kobach. This is on school spending, this one having to do with how much gets spent on administrators.
Over the past 20 years, I'll try to remember the numbers exactly. I think the number of teachers in the state has increased 16%, the number of administrators, 38%.
Have we seen an increase in administrators totaling nearly 40%, Celia?
Yeah, I thought this one was really interesting and easy to check. So not that I've been able to figure out, no. Now, I did reach out repeatedly to Kobach's campaign and ask, where'd you get these figures? How did you calculate it? How are you defining administrators? And I haven't gotten answers on that. So I pulled state data, and as best as I can figure out, so teachers are up 11% over the past 20 years, not 16%. Now, administrators, that's very interesting. The classic positions we think of, like superintendents and principals, that's actually down because schools and school districts continue to consolidate and close. Mm. But we have added a lot of directors. If you think one good example is 20 years ago, there weren't any technology directors at school districts. I mean, for obvious reasons, that's changed. Now there are 250 tech directors in the state. So,
because 20 years ago, there was no technology to direct, right?
So, right. Yeah. Now we have schools with, you know, iPads in every classroom, et cetera, you know. So if I add in all of those types of administrative positions, I'm looking at a 25% increase in administrators over the past 20 years. Still not approaching that, you know, 38%.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on here. A claim from Kobach. This one involves whether Kansas is a sanctuary state or not for illegal immigrants.
We are the sanctuary state of the Midwest, or the only state that does nothing to discourage illegal immigration.
Is that true, Jim McLean?
No, not according to an Associated Press. They did an extensive fact check on this claim, Steve.
Right.
He said this here in Johnson County just a few weeks ago, and the AP investigation found that to be mostly false. Now, while it is true that some surrounding states have passed laws or resolutions discouraging illegal immigration, Kansas hasn't, that has little to do with whether it's considered a quote-unquote sanctuary state. That designation, and this is according to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, applies to jurisdictions, cities, and states that refuse to cooperate with federal immigration officials. And according to the AP, a Trump administration list that was put out a long while ago that listed offending jurisdictions that included five Kansas counties simply wasn't accurate. So according to the AP analysis, nope, not true.
Okay. One more question about the accuracy of a claim from Secretary of State Kobach. Let's wrap this up with some audio from Democratic gubernatorial candidate Josh Swatty. This has to do with gun legislation.
We should have stopped this when we had the chance at 2015, and we needed Democrats that knew that then and knew enough to stand up and say no.
Stephen Bisaha, tell us about that one.
So this he's referring to is this constitutional carry bill that was put into place in 2015. This allows, in some cases, to have a concealed carry weapon, conceal and carry a weapon without a concealed carry permit. And the candidate Swatty was attacking with this was Laura Kelly. His opponent. She sponsored that legislation, actually. And she has since said that she believes that bill had gone too far. Again, that bill was what led to things like guns being allowed on college campuses here. But she's also hit Swatty back, saying that he has his own record of support of gun rights, same as she does.
And that's so you have questions with his claim there as well.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was in the legislature himself from, I believe, around 2003 to 2009. And both himself and Kelly had consistently voted for gun rights.
OK, we're going to leave our fact checking there. I want to thank our Kansas News Service reporters, Celia Yopis Jepson, Jim McLean and Stephen Bisaha. Thank you all for a good rundown. Sure. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about bus transit in the Kansas City area and how well it connects people to the jobs they hold. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You may not believe this, but it's true. Yesterday, two very patient romance authors helped me understand why their genre is worth reading, and it's worth a lot of money. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, with more women committing crimes, it should come as no surprise that TV is creating shows around that very topic, why there are more female criminals and how TV portrays them. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City has had a horrible reputation when it comes to its public transportation network and its ability to get people to jobs. That's right, the city's bus system wasn't seen as very efficient at moving people from their homes to their places of employment. But that may be changing. A new study shows that from 2016 to 2017, the KC Metro experienced a big jump in the number of jobs accessible via public transit. In fact, the 17% boost was the largest in the nation. But there's still some troubling news attached to this. That is, Kansas City is still ranked 40th in the country when it comes to overall job accessibility by transit. Now, a conversation about the effectiveness of Kansas City's public transit system. With us, Ron Acapul is Director of Transportation and Environment for the Mid-America Regional Council based here in Kansas City. Ron, good to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
Andrew Owen is director of the Accessibility Observatory at the University of Minnesota's Center for Transportation Studies that conducts nationwide studies on transportation. Andrew, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Ron, so Kansas City ranked first in the nation when it comes to this increase in connecting people to their jobs with our public transit system. Have you guys broken out the champagne there in the offices of the Mid-America Regional Council to celebrate this milestone?
Well, Steve, that was really good news. We've been working on job access with transit for a number of years with the Ride KC partners. We were really gratified to get that result, but as you pointed out, it's tempered a little bit because we're still pretty low ranked in terms of other metropolitan areas around the country in terms of job access.
Andrew, how significant is this increase? How should Kansas Cityans regard it here?
Well, I definitely think it's a really positive sign, and I like the way you're interpreting this a lot. Of ranked 40th to start with, you know, to put a positive spin on it means that there's a lot of room for some really easy improvements. But they don't happen by default. It takes people thinking about where to make investments and what sort of plans to make to turn that opportunity into these actual gains. So I think it is a really good sign. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming years and see if Kansas City maintains this sort of growth.
You know, Andrew, just so we're clear here, does this bump indicate that jobs in the metro are increasing, or has the public transit system actually improved by a whole lot, or maybe is it a little bit of both?
It probably is a little bit of both. I think in the case of the Kansas City results, we are seeing a larger impact from the transit network improvements. Jobs in the region did increase a little bit during this period, but not enough to make this 17% growth. It is helped a little bit if jobs locate more in places where there's transit than just throughout the region. So it might be some targeted growth in jobs and population, but I think mostly the transit system.
Ron Acapul, again with Mark, what did you guys do to increase access for people to actually get them to their jobs via public transit?
Well, there are a couple pretty significant changes in this data. I understood that the transit information was based on schedules from 2017, so that would have included the streetcar for the first time, and that's this did not really calculate ridership, but it reflects kind of higher levels of service in an area in the region that has really high concentrations of jobs already.
I was going to ask you about the streetcar, even though it only goes 2.5 miles or something. You're saying it's had an impact.
Well, it's had an impact in increased service in that area. It's also had an impact in attracting employment and also residential development around there too, which is another important part of Andrew's report.
Along that streetcar corridor you're talking about.
And to Andrew's earlier point about the jobs growth, we do think that was probably a pretty significant part of this. When we took a look at some of the data, we saw about a 2% job growth overall in the region during that period, but about a 3% growth in the corridor from downtown to the plaza. And so that's indicating that there is some accelerated growth in areas that are served by transit, which is a different trend than we've seen in the past.
So, Ron, if we wind up expanding the streetcar system from Crown Center out to UMKC, is that going to result in yet another boost for us?
It's really hard to predict exactly how it would impact this kind of an analysis. We think it would be helpful in continuing to attract jobs and attract development along the corridor. That corridor is one that in the region we've been looking at for a long time, many years, many attempts at light rail. It's a spine that's really amenable to high quality public transit service, and we certainly support the expansion of the system.
Andrew, anytime you add to a system like what we're talking about here with our streetcar, I imagine it really can't help but help our numbers when it comes to the studies that you're doing here.
That's right. It's hard to add transit service and not see a response in improved access to jobs. I think the question to ask, though, is, are we making investments that bring us the biggest accessibility benefit for the dollar? And to do that, it's important to look at a bunch of different opportunities and see if we invest here, mm-hmm. how will that play out in terms of improving accessibility?
Well, is your point that one factor here is that the streetcar system is so darn expensive compared to traditional bus services that we should maybe take a look at that?
So rail systems are much more expensive typically to build than bus systems. That doesn't mean that they're a bad idea. It just means they need to be done when they are the best idea. I think something that's a little bit overlooked in evaluating how much the streetcar increased accessibility in Kansas City is the fact that its impact was expanded, increased enormously by its integration with the Max express bus systems. Mm-hmm. If those weren't there, I think we would have seen a much, much smaller impact from just adding the streetcar in the absence of the connecting Max service.
Yeah. Andrew, should we be discouraged by the 40th place standing across the country in terms of where we rank for getting people to their jobs via public transit? How should we regard that figure?
Yeah, so discouragement, I think, is not a helpful response to it. That figure reflects decisions and development outcomes in the region that have happened over the past decades, and that's what led to where things are right now. I think that we can take a much more positive view of things for Kansas City based on the fact that that the decisions being made there, that the leadership is taking advantage of, there's a lot of room for catching up. Kansas City actually ranks 25th in the nation, much, much higher than its 40th place by accessibility, 25th by total employment, which means there are a lot of jobs there that people can be connected to. And the right transit investments can help to shorten that gap between those ranks potentially very quickly.
Ron, I can't help but think that Kansas City is a city of 319 square miles. We're one of the largest in the nation. To what extent does that suggest that we're still, we're just too big to have an efficient and effective public transit system, given the extent to which we sprawl all over the place around here?
Well, I think one of the takeaways from some of the recent planning we've done on the transit system is we're never going to have an effective system that relies on one kind of transit, and that one of the important parts of the Smart Moves update that we adopted last year is just recognizing how many other kinds of services we need to be building off on and other kinds of innovations we need to be adding to the transit system.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, this study really looks at the impact of fixed route transit, the rail systems, fixed route buses. We also see van pools as an important part of the picture for providing job access. We see a really strong potential future role for transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft to be integrated into the transit system. We're also kind of lagging behind some of our peers in terms of our bicycle and pedestrian networks in the region, and that's an important way of getting to transit and using transit.
So that's changing too, though, right?
It sure is. We've been making good progress. The city of Kansas City and other cities in the metro area have been investing a lot in trails and in on-road bike facilities and in pedestrian infrastructure. The Kansas City's recent geobond initiative that includes a significant amount of money for sidewalk repair will be really helpful for that as well. So I think one of the important takeaways for us out of this, out of the planning work we've done, has been how important it is to think about integrating lots of different modes of transportation together into the job access equation.
And we're talking this morning on Up to Date about the effectiveness of our public transit system at getting people from their homes to their jobs. I also don't get the sense, Ron, that we're ready here in our communities to invest heavily more dollars in public transit. And there seems to be a cap on that, as there would be, I guess, in any community. Am I seeing that correctly?
So in Kansas City area, the way we fund public transportation is really kind of a patchwork of funding. The lion's share of money that goes into the transit system actually comes from two sales taxes in Kansas City, Missouri. The ATA, Area Transportation Authority, that operates a lot of the services in the region, does so by contracting individually with cities and counties to some extent. And so recently, through the Ride KC brand, there's been a lot of efficiencies gained in having the ATA take over the management of some of the contracts for services in Johnson County and in Independence and with the Unified Government in Wyandotte County. But we have all kinds of differential rates of participation in paying for transit services in our region. Another issue, we don't get a lot of state help, either from Kansas and particularly from Missouri, in funding transit here. And in a lot of places around the country, the states are a lot more active in funding public transportation services. That's just not been historically the case here. It's gone down over the years, particularly in Missouri as the recession hit. So it's a funding is a really complex issue, and the way we go about funding is not the most efficient that of places in the country that have regional funding mechanisms.
Right. I want to get our listeners involved here. How would you rate Kansas City's public transit system? How effective is it at getting people to their jobs? What's your sense? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Andrew, can you explain to me in a way that would be able for our listeners to grasp just how you gathered the data for this study that then ranked the cities in the way that it did?
Sure. So there's two main types of data that we need to do this work. The first is that we need to know where the jobs are. And fortunately, we've got some great data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau that gives us that in a consistent format across the whole country. So that part's pretty easy. The more complicated part is we need to know how quickly people can move around in cities by transit. So we need to know transit schedules really for everywhere in the country. That takes a little bit more effort. We have to go out and visit, reach out to each transit operator. We've got a list of several hundred, and we collect transit schedule information that goes stop by stop and says, you know, when are the buses going to arrive here? When are the trains going to arrive right here? We take all that information, we, you know, knit it all together into a network with those jobs attached to it, and then we pick up individual origins and we say, all right, if you are here, you know, in this particular block, and given these schedules, how far could you get within 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes? And we can just sort of draw, they're usually not circles, but we can draw circles on the map that show this is the boundary of how far you could reach. Then we add up how many jobs are within those circles. It's conceptually a pretty simple thing to do. The fun part is doing it at a national scale so that we can answer those questions about each of the 11 million blocks that make up the U.S.
I was going to say, you know, the percentage increase for Kansas City is a huge jump from last year when Kansas City ranked dead last in job accessibility via transit growth. That almost seems like an anomaly. Do you have a sense, Andrew, what caused such a significant jump in what we're looking at here?
Yeah, you're right that was a really big change in transit access year over year. My sense of the results in our 2016 report is that they may have been strongly influenced actually by the construction of the streetcar system. And that's based on some suspicions related to projects that we've seen in my hometown in Minneapolis, where we recently finished construction of a new light rail system. And during the construction of that project, there were actually some pretty negative impacts on transit schedules. Buses were detoured, traffic was congested in response to construction, which slowed buses down. So it's actually possible that we are seeing sort of a spring effect where things were kind of dampened or made a little bit worse during that construction period, and then are springing back and enjoying new benefits from the streetcar being there.
Lots of people want to talk about how effective our public transit system is at getting people to work. Let's go to some calls now. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. Great, great topic. Thank you very much.
Sure.
One thing that this ignores, and that most of the city, the white people anyway, ignore, and that up to this moment this conversation hasn't touched on yet, is that we ignore completely the east side of the city and the residents there, people of color. And so the segregation that was very legally set up, wrongly but legally set up so many decades ago, is still in effect, and it keeps people who want and yes need jobs away from better jobs and better pay, because there's, you know, yeah, there's buses, but we ignore the east side of the city with mass transit completely.
How about that notion, Ron, that we're ignoring the east side?
Well, I dispute that a little bit. I think that there's some merit to what the caller is saying, but I think you know, there have been some really significant investments in transit service in the east side recently. The Troost MAX came online a few years ago.
The Prospect MAX.
Prospect MAX is being planned right now and will be constructed very soon. We're looking at the Independence Avenue corridor as well. In terms of where transit service is strongest, it probably is strongest on the east side. The deficiency is it's difficult to you know, it's easy to move around in the east side. It's difficult to get from the east side to other parts of the region north of the river, across the state line. That is an area that we are concerned about.
And the east side did say no to a streetcar extension over there, so that maybe plays into this as well. Yeah. Let's go back to some calls. And Vicki from Kansas City, Missouri. Vicki, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for letting me just say a few words.
Sure.
About our experience. My husband and I are a one-car family. We rely on the bus system in order for him to go to work. And we have really experienced a pretty strong impact from the cutting of some of the smaller lines in the city. So the 47, the 51, the 57 have all had either decreases in the route or decreases in frequency. And so unless you're able to use the MAX system, at this point it's not a reliable way to get around the city and get to work. So we're actually having to relocate to closer to our jobs as a result of those cuts.
Ron?
The ATA has gone through a process of kind of reevaluating a lot of their routes, and caller's correct. There has been cuts on some of the lower volume routes to divert some resources onto routes that have higher ridership.
Okay. Let's go to Nick from Lee Summit. Nick, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you. My question is, what are the plans for the Rock Island Rail Corridor? And I'll take my answer off air, please.
Yeah, I appreciate the phone call, Nick. Thank you. And Ron, this
Thank
is
you.
The fixed rail line that former county executive Mike Sanders was talking about that would bring folks in from the suburbs and outlying areas into downtown Kansas City.
Absolutely. So the current status of that project is that Jackson County and KCATA have jointly purchased the Rock Island right-of-way and are in the process right now of constructing a trail along it, which eventually will connect into the Katy Trail and be able to connect across the state of Missouri. So if you want to ride a bike across the state, the state will have one of the more significant trail systems to do that. Longer term, and I think the real motivation for the ATA's involvement in the project is to provide some type of really high-capacity transit service in the corridor. The ATA has also hired a company to look at the development potential along that corridor. And so there are no concrete plans yet for transit service, but the idea is that in the intermediate to long term, we will be providing that. The commuter rail service that we were looking at a few years ago was really complicated by the difficulty of getting in and the cost of getting into Union Station.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, there's really not an active plan for the commuter rail service in Jackson County, but it's still an idea that is worth pursuing.
James wants to know, where's the KCI MAX?
Great question. Airport transit service is another area that we've identified in our planning work and are working with the ATA on now.
Ian from Shawnee. Ian, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I'm a relatively new frequent rider. I take the 475 bus in Johnson County to my work, and I could drive. It takes me a little longer to take the bus, but it's almost the same amount of time. And so I just wanted to say that I appreciate the bus system, you know, and their frequent stops and expanded stops. I'd like to suggest maybe doing more evening and weekend hours, not just for that line, but for a lot of the lines that travel to the Missouri side or northeast Johnson County as well.
Right. Ian, duly noted. I appreciate it. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Ron Acapole, Director of Transportation and Environment for the Mid-America Regional Council. Andrew Owen is Director of the Accessibility Observatory at the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies. Thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, pundits from Kansas and Missouri survey the political and campaign landscape for voters and candidates alike. There's a lot on the line. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.